From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes, editor of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show this week are Oren Durell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. And here are the issues. Donald Trump has selected the head of a giant energy company, Exxon, to be a Secretary of State. In Washington, the Central Intelligence Agency created a political furor by concluding that Russia tried to help Trump win the election. And the world learned through photographs of the suffering of Syrians in Aleppo, where the Syrian government, aided by Russian and Iranian forces, are waging a brutal attack to capture the city. Well, Michael, let's start with a man named Rex Tillerson, who I believe is 65 years old and has been with Exxon for many years. I think he's been the president for a dozen years, perhaps. An odd choice for Secretary of State. What did you make of it?
It was an unusual choice because we'd had so many names that were floated in front of us who were much more familiar, certainly with more political experience, you know, at all, even if you, if they weren't necessarily experienced in foreign policy. We'll make one correction. He's 64 years old, famously.
64, because boy, I tell you.
65 in March, and that's mandatory retirement for Exxon.
I hate being corrected.
Well, they will put him out to pasture at Exxon next March, so he'll be looking for something to do. And this is sort of an interesting, you know, post-career type of move, Secretary of State. Obviously, he's had a range of experience dealing with governments around the world. I guess most significantly, people are concerned about his relationship with Putin. And we've had a number of senators come forward with concerns about that, him winning the Order of Friendship and this great relationship that he has with Putin and calling him a close friend. And he has allied with him to do a number of multi-billion dollar deals. The issues arise where you look at the obvious conflicts that can arise from that situation. You have maybe the competence of the man balanced with what are really his issues and concerns. What is his feeling towards Vladimir Putin? And will he put U.S. interests overall, which aren't necessarily oil interests and money interests, ahead of what has clearly been a money, oil, gas, energy-based relationship with Putin and Russia, and basically with all of the relationships that he's had internationally throughout his career?
Well, Oren, he's certainly going to have to distinguish in confirmation hearings, which I guess will begin next month, January, that he does know the difference between the interests of a giant oil company and the interests of the United States of America.
Yeah, well, several senators, like Michael said, and especially Lindsey Graham, the Republican from South Carolina, have said that they're going to be asking Rex Tillerson a lot of questions about this particular issue and about his relationship with Vladimir Putin. One of the things about Tillerson is that he does have management experience, obviously. He's operated one of the biggest oil companies in the country. And he's done all these deals, have been with some people that were basically they were under U.S. sanctions for Russia's activities in Ukraine. He partnered ExxonMobil with Rosneft, which is the big oil company in Russia that is led by Igor Sechin, who's on sanctions list. He's a Putin ally. And there's a lot of questions about what's going to happen with U.S. policy, you know, in Ukraine, which the rest of Europe feels, you know, many of our allies there feel that Ukraine is kind of the front line of Europe against Russian aggression. And his close relationship, his cooperation with Russia, it brings all that into question. I want to say that it's interesting, if you look at what he's said about his work in Russia, he talks about having to find a partner that he can work with and avoiding the mistakes that ExxonMobil made earlier, where they partnered with Yukos, which is another oil company that got taken over and ran afoul of the government. So he realized, you know, basically their strategy was to work with friends of Putin in order to get ahead.
Michael, what do you think Donald Trump picked Rex Tillerson? You mentioned that he talked to a lot of people, Mitt Romney, who had been the Republican presidential nominee in 2012, David Petraeus, the famous American general, Bob Corker, the senator from Tennessee. I could spend the rest of the show talking just listing the people.
Absolutely.
What was it, do you think, other than the fact that Trump found him charming and so on, why would he pick a guy like Rex Tillerson? I was surprised.
Well, if you look at the track record of the picks for this administration so far, if you look for a pattern, one of the things that you see is that Donald Trump is impressed mostly by money and power. And that means very, very accomplished business people or very, very accomplished generals. That's the preponderance of the appointments right now. So I think that Rex Tillerson, with his accomplishments, certainly he's an accomplished businessman.
Indeed.
He's an exceptional businessman. There's no question about that. And I think that's something that Donald Trump holds in very, very high regard. I don't think that he holds career politicians in very high regard. And he's in line with a lot of America in that way right now. So I think that he feels that with his skill set, he'll be able to come in and implement the Donald Trump doctrine. The big question is, what exactly is that doctrine? Does it match with current foreign policy in any way? And can he get the sort of disparate pieces that he's put together for foreign policy into the defense apparatus for his administration? Can he make all those disparate and sort of maybe sometimes conflicting pieces work together?
Orrin, I want to read you something by Max Boot. Max Boot, you're probably familiar with, but is a conservative foreign policy and national security analyst. And here's something he wrote about Rex Tillerson. He says, serving a president with strong moral grounding and certain fixed principles, such as Ronald Reagan or George W. Bush, he, meaning Tillerson, might have been successful in sanding off the rough edges and making the compromises necessary to get things done. But under Donald Trump, a man of few, if any, discernible principles beyond a desire for self-aggrandizement, he would be a dangerous choice because his role will not be just to implement policy, but, more than most previous secretaries of state, to shape it. Is that a problem? I mean, that he, a man who's not experienced in government and handling foreign affairs, would be working for a president who doesn't have any experience in the field either.
I think it depends on what his goals in shaping it would be. I would disagree that Rex Tillerson doesn't have experience in government and foreign affairs. He doesn't have experience in government, but he has a lot of experience dealing with governments. In fact, there was another article written by Stephen Cole, who wrote a whole book about ExxonMobil as an empire and a non-government, basically government that has its own foreign policy and was pursuing its own foreign policy goals that sometimes were contrary to the United States under Rex Tillerson. They've got huge operations. They deal a lot with governments and heads of state. They've got more operations and more investment in some countries than the United States provides in assistance to those countries. So he's been working these deals and working these relationships for decades. I mean, he has a lot of experience. The question is, what is he going to do with it?
Yeah, Michael, the one thing he has to do first, Rex Tillerson does, is appear before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, where three Republicans, John McCain, Lindsey Graham, and Marco Rubio, have all been expressed doubts about Tillerson. If all the Democrats and those three Republicans voted against confirming the nomination of Rex Tillerson, then it would be over. It would never go to the floor of the Senate, and he could not be confirmed. Now, Marco Rubio said in particular that, and it's been widely quoted, of course, that he thought being a friend of Vladimir Putin, which Tillerson supposedly is, anyway, that's who he was referring to, being a friend of Vladimir Putin is not what he's really looking for in a new Secretary of State. But what about this trio of Republicans, which has made the this nomination somewhat in doubt?
Well, it's been clear for some time that there's a group of senators who are not going to serve as a rubber stamp for the Trump administration in every single thing that he wants to do. I think it's a very mature and reasonable thing in their role to advise and consent for the president is to properly vet this person before they give him a rubber stamp and make him not only Secretary of State, I believe fourth in line for the presidency. I mean, this is Secretary of State and Secretary of the Treasury. Let's get this straight. These are the two most noble and prestigious cabinet positions.
Well, there is the Defense Department.
And defense as well. I guess I'm sort of partial to Treasury and State. But the Senate is going to take a very close look at him. And it's also very interesting that the chairman of that committee is Bob Corker, who is someone who was being considered for that position. And he's come down in an extremely neutral position on this. Mm-hmm. Let's take a look, see. But the committee hearings are going to be fascinating to see mm-hmm. exactly how aggressively he is questioned and vetted mm-hmm. by the Republicans.
Well, he'll have to do well. But, you know, I've been in Washington a long time, and I've seen similar situations happen. And I suspect with a Republican president nominating Rex Tillerson that somehow McCain and Graham and Rubio will find the answers from Tillerson during the hearing satisfactory, and he'll get through the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and then be confirmed on the floor.
Presidents usually are given a lot of leeway in their appointments or nominations, and I think that the proof will be in the pudding of his behavior in office. Mm. You know, we'll just have to see. I mean, I think that, like Michael said, a lot of these appointments and Rex Tillerson's appointment or nomination shows that Trump's goals are commercial mm-hmm. and expanding U.S. industry and access to markets. Mm-hmm. That's going to be the focus.
You know, I'm going to quote from Max Boot, who I happen to know, but anyway, his piece was good and raised the right questions. And I'm going to read this short thing again because we haven't heard where Rex Tillerson stands on any issues, but here's the way Max wrote about it. He said, Tillerson is a tabula rasa. What does he think about the U.S. alliance with Israel, the U.S. policy toward Pakistan, the future of NATO, the North Korean nuclear program, Chinese aggression in the South China Sea, Syria and Iraq, Libya and Yemen? No one knows because he seldom has opined in public about non-energy issues.
Yeah, it's a thing. We have famously not heard from Rex Tillerson. I haven't mm-hmm. seen an extensive interview mm-hmm. with him. I suppose that there are a number of our colleagues who are working on that at this moment to get him on tape, on camera, and try to get some sort of fleshing out of what these things are. Look, I think one of the interesting quotes that Donald Trump made when he made this nomination was that Rex Tillerson is friends with a lot of people who don't like us. Mm-hmm. And okay, that's fine. But you know, we're not looking for a master of ceremonies sure. here. We're looking mm-hmm. for a chief diplomat mm-hmm. to manage our foreign policy.
And I don't mean to belabor Tillerson, but Michael, as you said, it's right at the top. It's probably the most prestigious and important of the cabinet positions, I think. And Tillerson is not George Shultz. You know, some people have said, well, George Shultz came out of the Bechtel Corporation to become Secretary of State under Ronald Reagan. But there was a difference here. He had been Labor Secretary, Shultz had, and he'd been Treasury Secretary. He'd been the Budget Director at the White House, and he had also been involved as Treasury Secretary in the famous Paris meeting in 1973 that they decided to get rid of the Bretton Woods regime and let currencies float. In this regard, I think Tillerson, compared to Shultz and just in general, is unique.
So I wouldn't want this to sound like I'm not skeptical or cautious about mm-hmm. this recommendation, but there are two things to consider. One is that I think from Donald Trump's point of view, Rex Tillerson is somebody who got things done mm-hmm. despite the fact that he was working in countries that don't like the United States, that aren't friends of the United States. Mm-hmm. But also, his deputy is going to be John Bolton.
Yeah.
Who is a controversial figure for sure, but he definitely has a lot of experience
Indeed.
And was at the State Department for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he's definitely a hardliner, mm-hmm. John Bolton is, and he definitely has strong views about foreign policy and who's America's friend and who isn't. But he'll be, I'm sure, if he's a deputy, he'll be helping Tillerson navigate what he doesn't know in terms of the bureaucracy.
Very good. We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes, of the Weekly Standard. Joining me today are Michael Williams of CBS Radio and Oren Durrell of USA Today. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Well, let's turn to this CIA finding, that's the Central Intelligence Agency finding, that Russia, through its hacking of Hillary Clinton's emails that involved Hillary Clinton, and they were basically to try to tilt the election toward Donald Trump. They're alone in this opinion because the FBI doesn't agree, and more importantly, the Director of National Intelligence has not endorsed this either, which I think since the director has not endorsed it, it would indicate, I think, that there is no, that the National Security Agency has not gotten any signal information, you know, emails or phone calls or things that would indicate that this is what the Russians were doing. Anyway, It's created a political furor. Where do you think we stand, Orrin, on this?
Where do we stand? How much background do we need to add into this? There was this massive hacking effort, yeah. And now that President Obama has ordered a full review by the entire intelligence community of what happened since 2008 or something like that. And he's promising that the United States will take action in response. What that action will be, he's saying, or when it will be, he's saying, in the manner and time of our choosing.
It seems like he's
asking for this review to be delivered by the 20th, which is when his last day in office. Mm-hmm. So it's not clear when this action is going to happen, if it does. And Donald Trump, the president-elect, is very skeptical and is, you know, basically saying that these are the same people that told us about the WMDs, weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and he's criticizing the whole thing. And then sending out tweets about, you know, are we talking about the information that exposed Hillary's wrongdoing, or that she got questions ahead of time from CNN during the debate? It's unclear where this is going to head, but there will be apparently a review and an investigation in Congress.
You know, the New York Times had a long piece a few days ago, Michael, about the hacking that Russians had done over the last couple of years. Why didn't President Obama do anything about it over the last 2 years? And now he is acting.
That's a very, very, very good question. And it doesn't have really a very solid answer from anyone yet. I mean, just to backtrack a little bit, I mean, the reason behind this has been reported since the summer. A number of major outlets, Politico, Time Magazine, talked about the fact that there is no secret that Hillary Clinton was a very unpopular person in the Russian government. And there was a perception by Putin that Hillary Clinton had been responsible for meddling in Russian politics at some point, inciting sort of protests during his political campaigns. And there's the word vendetta has come up in talking about what's happened with this whole hacking thing. So that's the one thing. So we know why. The thing that I'd like to see is someone in the administration. We haven't put a face to this accusation or to this finding. It's all been based on reports, based on findings. There is no face. And by contrast, when the North Koreans allegedly hacked Sony Corporation, not allegedly, they did hack Sony Corporation, the president got up on a soapbox and said, this is what happened. We are going to retaliate. And that's for hacking a movie company. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we really felt that he was hacking the political process, why not stand up for it? The argument that's been given from some people I've talked to within the administration is that he didn't want to affect the election. Well, high irony, if the election is already being affected, why would you not take a stand and say, not just Democrats, but the American political system is being hacked? His popularity was at a place at that point where I think he could have taken the move to actually bring this out and have someone address it.
Mm-hmm. So this issue, actually, apparently the White House and the president's advisors had heated debates over exactly what to do and how to respond. And like Michael says, they didn't want to escalate with Russia, and they were afraid that that it would create a cyber war. The president apparently was worried about causing a cyber war with Russia. I think that one of the issues here that is lost is that the it's going to sound alarmist, but this is on the spectrum of warfare for the Russians. Mm-hmm. They have this war doctrine that starts with information warfare and subversive tactics like what we're seeing, and that are meant to destabilize and confuse the enemy. We're under attack. And I think our government has to, and our leaders have to respond accordingly.
Let's turn in the last part of the show to Aleppo. You know, these photographs that come out of there that have been sent out, I don't know, emailed or on Instagram or whatever. I mean, we have this modern technology that there really aren't reporters or news photographers. There are a lot of people and have sent out these really horrible pictures of the suffering there. This has not been, you know, one thing I've noticed just in the last few days, and particularly in the Washington Post, there was a brutal editorial criticizing the Obama administration for doing so little about Syria and Aleppo in particular.
Yeah, in hindsight, And I think even on this show, we talked many times about the red line that was drawn and never enforced, that sort of thing. I mean, the pictures, yes, are horrible. And quite frankly, I find it very difficult to sit in a forum like this and discuss it dispassionately and in an academic fashion, because it really does raise a lot of your emotions as a human being to how this type of tragedy could occur.
Let me add one other thing. The Obama administration has, I think, been negligent. The Republicans haven't been demanding, for the most part, haven't been demanding that the administration do something either.
No, they haven't. In the past couple of days, I've seen speeches by Samantha Power in the UN, sort of blistering speeches about the Russians and have you no shame. And very similar words from John Kerry at the State Department and have you no shame. They're accusatory and they're sharp, but they lack gravitas because we did nothing as well. We're trying to shame people into changing their behavior when they are actually prosecuting their war in exactly the fashion they want to, and in their perception, it's working perfectly. So how do you bring someone to the negotiation table just by trying to get them to take the moral high ground? They are winning the war in the way that they want to win the war. And you keep hearing this phrase from the administration, there is no military solution. Well, Assad and the Russians tend to disagree. There is a military solution, and it's apparently annihilation.
Oren?
I've been covering this conflict since it started, so I find it heartbreaking and very frustrating to see what's happening there. The latest development that I notice, you know, watching from, at this point, somewhat from afar, is that, first of all, as Michael said, U.S. administration, John Kerry, Samantha Power, they talk and they try to shame and they complain about what's happening. They really haven't really put much skin in the game at all. When it comes to countering the Russians and Assad, there is a concern that going against the Russians will start some kind of a war with the Russians. Not everybody, including people like Robert Gates, the former Secretary of Defense, think that he has recommended challenging the Russians in the air, challenging the Syrians on the ground. But what's happening, actually, is that in Aleppo, this discussion on a ceasefire in Aleppo, for all these months has been happening between the United States and Russia. Well, now that it's actually taking place, the discussions are between Russia and Turkey. And that shows that what the Russians are actually interested in is to elbow or push or shoulder the United States out of the way and make it irrelevant in the region, or at least irrelevant in Syria, and to pursue its goals.
Well, they are succeeding.
They are.
In elbowing America out. Donald Trump's foreign policy views, to the extent we know them, are ones that are not to expand America's influence in the Middle East. That's not one of them.
Well, actually, his goal in Syria is to work with Russia and with Bashar Assad against the Islamic State, which Russia and Bashar Assad have never actually been all that focused on the Islamic State. I think something like a tenth of their activities or less have been focused on the Islamic State. But once the rebels are defeated, which now it looks like that's going to happen soon, then they'll be free to focus on the Islamic State, and Trump wants to work with them. But the problem is that there's a contradiction, because also working with Assad is Iran, and Donald Trump has a very anti-Iran posture. So it's not clear how working with Assad, which is who's completely strengthened and buttressed by Iran, is going to be is going to fit together with his policy.
Michael, do you want to add something very quickly, because we're going to have to wind up here?
No, we just know that there are 100,000 people left in Aleppo, and 8,000 have gotten out so far. And state government released Syrian state government released a note that said that 8,000 terrorists and their families have gotten out so far. So that's the way they feel about these people. Oh, it doesn't look good.
That's all the time we have. Joining us today were Oren Durell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers were Justin Thwaites and Linus Rimkus. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.